It's good to see everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started on some Genesis. We are going to pick up where we left off at the end of chapter 42. We'll make a real brief recap of the last few chapters. We're in the period of the life of Joseph, where last week we saw how God was able to finally bring an end to Joseph's personal struggles and sufferings and all the things he had to go through. And then also we saw how God was planning all along to use Joseph's life, despite all the things he went through, as a way of blessing a lot of other people, as a way of really blessing the whole world. And so today what we're going to pick up is, now that we've seen how things work out for Joseph, we're going to see how things work out for the rest of his family. Because all the while Joseph was living through all these tough times in Egypt, his family had their own lives going on. And all the time that Joseph was finally taking a position in life that he could find some satisfaction and some joy in, his family still had a lot of spiritual needs. They had a lot of issues. They had a lot of baggage. They had a lot of problems. And we're going to see that God has never forgotten about them either. God loved Joseph, blessed him for his faithfulness, took care of him after all these years of suffering. God also loved his brothers, despite all their sins, despite all their flaws. And so we're going to see what God does with them this week to kind of put that together. We're getting towards the end of the book of Genesis here, and as we get towards the end of the book of Genesis, you'll see how God kind of brings a lot of things together at what you could see in a sense as the end of an era and the start of a brand new era. John Lindsay is going to go ahead and lead us in a short time of prayer, and then we'll get ready to study some Genesis. He's got to set his coffee down and lick the donut off of his paws there, but looks like he's ready to go now.
Our Father in heaven, we are indeed thankful to you for being our Father. Father, you are so full of love and compassion, justice and mercy. Father, your greatest desire is for us to love you, to respect your word, Father, to follow you, Lord, just to wait upon you and your promises. Help us, Father, this morning to be open-hearted to you, to really appreciate you for what Jesus does each and every day. We humbly ask you to bless Mark as he speaks to us, that your Spirit will guide his words, and that we may be attentive and, Lord, be lifted up in our faith. Thank you for your words, Father, from beginning to end, Father, that it's revealed your heart, your character, your plans for us. Help us to always respect the word, Father, just remember that you're in control, and that someday soon we'll be with you. Thank you. Please forgive us, Father, for sinning against you. Help us to honor you in every way. In Christ we pray, Father.
Amen. All right. Thanks very much. We've been studying the life of Joseph, and a couple weeks ago we looked at his life in Egypt, the experiences that he went through as a result of having his brothers sell him as a slave. And if that wasn't bad enough, being taken by your own relatives and sold as a slave, Joseph's life in Egypt, he caused him to experience further unjustness and unfairness and things that were very difficult to deal with, the kind of things that would cause a lot of people to question their faith in God or even lose their faith in God. And yet Joseph concentrated on making himself a blessing to others. Joseph dealt with those things in a way that didn't necessarily change things for him on the surface, but he made himself a blessing to others. We have that phrase that you see a number of times, that the Lord was with him. And the thing that is interesting to notice is that when the Lord was with him, the recipients of most of the things that Joseph did were other people, and oftentimes others who didn't even deserve it. And that's because God was using Joseph, preparing Joseph for something very important. Joseph's life was never about Joseph himself. Joseph's life was about God. And God was teaching Joseph some things, leading Joseph to be completely dependent on God for some important purposes. And we started to see this and understand a little bit better last time when we looked at these chapters 41 and 22, which have these periods of plenty and periods of famine. After all these years that Joseph suffered a lot of unfairness, being a slave, being tossed in jail, one morning he wakes up and the guard's banging on his jail cell, and he's got a message for Joseph. Someone wants to see him. And it is
Pharaoh.
It's the Pharaoh. He says, hey, guess what? You're going before Pharaoh today. And Joseph had done nothing special that day. It had been 2 years since he'd met the Pharaoh's cupbearer and the baker and interpreted their dreams. He's long since lost hope that they're going to tell anybody about him. But what's happened back in the palace is Pharaoh's had these troubling dreams, and no one can help him with them. And the royal cupbearer remembers this guy that he'd met in prison, and he'd always meant to tell someone about this guy because he knew he was in there for something he didn't do. And he'd forgotten all about it, and he tells Pharaoh about this. So Joseph, one morning, he didn't do anything special, and all of a sudden his life changes. And he's had this experience before, but in a very negative way. He's had the experience before of waking up in the morning, going out to do the chores that his dad sent him to do, and his brothers pounced on him, tossed him in a cistern, and then sold him as a slave. That wasn't a very good day. He had another day where he was going about his business for his master, Potiphar, and he was doing these things, and all of a sudden this slippery wife of his master accuses him falsely, and he's tossed in jail. That wasn't a very good day either. Well, this is going to be the reverse, because he wakes up one morning as a prisoner in a dungeon, and when he goes to sleep at night, he's the second highest ruler in all of Egypt. And it's because Pharaoh's had these dreams, and he had these dreams, if you remember, they're kind of surreal. They're the kind of things you see on the Twilight Zone. You have these seven real nice juicy looking cows walking along, and then all of a sudden these seven scrawny looking cows swallow them up, which is weird in a lot of ways because cows aren't even carnivores to begin with. But especially to the Egyptians, to the Pharaoh, the cow was an important religious symbol to the Egyptians. It was very important economically as well, and so the Pharaoh was very troubled by this. He had a similar dream where the seven nice healthy stalks of grain were sprouting up out of the ground, and then seven scraggly scrawny stalks of grain swallowed up the seven healthy ones. And when Joseph comes on the scene, he's able to tell Pharaoh, this is something God has decided. He's revealed it to you for a lot of reasons. And you start to see how God's working in a lot of ways at the same time. There's going to be 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. And the reason why God has sent this dream to Pharaoh is because he wants Pharaoh to save up some extra grain and extra food for all these 7 years, because otherwise everybody in the world's going to starve during those 7 years of famine. And Pharaoh himself wouldn't have done this. It's only because of Joseph coming on the scene. And so Joseph gets this new life. He interprets the dreams. He gives Pharaoh the advice. And Pharaoh says, well, the best person in the world to do this is you. You're the only one who seems to understand what's going on. So Joseph all of a sudden has this new life. Lots of gifts, lots of blessings. Gets to marry the daughter of one of Pharaoh's favorite officials. And yet to Joseph, despite the fact that for the first time in his life, or the first time since he was very young, he's blessed, he's an even bigger blessing to others. In fact, now he's not just blessing a few people that are close to him, he's blessing the whole world. But the thing to see about Joseph is, see, anyone can dream about something like Joseph finally achieved. Getting some important position, getting lots of opportunity for everyone to see you at work. But why did God choose Joseph for that position? It wasn't because Joseph was sitting studying all those years and just relaxing and waiting for the opportunity. It's because what was he doing all those years? He was making himself a blessing to others in little ways. And that's something that from a spiritual point of view, we would do well to appreciate a lot more, because remember what Jesus said, if someone gives you a cup of water because they're conscious of me, they're not going to lose their reward. And even in what we call ministry, it's very unfortunate that we so often emphasize the dramatic, the bold, the big gesture, the things everybody sees. But really the things that are the most meaningful to God and that give God the most joy are the things that you do that you make when you make yourself a blessing to people in little ways. Most of us are not ever going to be able to have the kind of position Joseph had. All of us are going to be around people with needs the way Joseph was for most of his life. All of you can be a blessing to others. In fact, most of you are blessings to others in ways that you probably don't even realize, because we don't often put the appreciation where it belongs. We often kind of single out certain people who do dramatic things or spend a lot of money or do something instead of realizing if you do things that make yourself a little blessing to people, Jesus says you're not going to lose your reward. You give someone thirsty a cup of water, you're not going to lose your reward to Jesus, even if the world never gives it to you. And, you know, one of the things that's great about being in Christ is that you know a lot of people who are blessings to others, not in the big dramatic ways, but in the ways that do mean something to God. You know, I'm not talking about all of you. You know, some of you are troublemakers, but most of you are real blessings to other people. You know, some of you are even nice to me, and that's God realizes that. God knows how difficult it is to deal with me, and those of you who are nice to me, you're going to be rewarded for it, for all the times you put up with me being kind of silly. And that's the kind of thing that we do well to appreciate. And so Joseph is really now a blessing to the whole world. And this is one of these situations where we so often focus on what is God going to do for me today to fix my little problem without realizing that God works on a much bigger scale, because you have Joseph's own personal situation that went on for years at a time without any fairness in human terms. Then you had his family. That they have a lot of problems. They have a lot of needs. We read about this young nation of Israel, the family of Israel. We know it's going to be very important. And yet you look at them, and everything they do is so rotten. The way they treat people, the way they think, the way they act, the way they talk, they're just so ungodly. What's God going to do about it? Well, God's got a plan for that. And then you have the world as a whole, not to mention in the middle all the people that met Joseph, the Potiphar's and the prison wardens and the other prisons. And God works on all these levels at once. God is not the kind of guy that just races around, oh, I got to fix that. Oh, no, let's fix that. Oh, no, let's fix that. He's the kind of God who sees everything. He doesn't see it from a worm's eye view like we do. He sees it from a God's eye view. And he has the superior wisdom and patience and power to make things happen in a way we can't. And so when we say we have faith in God, that's kind of what goes along with it, is we have to learn to see things from that perspective, that that's the way God works. Because you see in the life of Joseph, it's inherent in the fact that he trusted God, that he was patient, that he waited, that he could make himself a blessing all those years with no obvious recompense. And it's the kind of thing that makes him a good example for us. And as we see how things finally come to a head for Joseph, and he's finally gets things made right, so to speak, in his life. Now it's time to go back and see what's going to happen to the rest of these characters. The last time we saw these guys, they were a pretty rough bunch of customers. And it's been a long time. Joseph was 17 when they sold him as a slave. And it says he was 30 when Pharaoh appointed him as the governor of Egypt's economy. And then as a good couple years later, when his brothers, or as good, it's 7 years later when the famine starts, and it's a couple more years later when his brothers come to Egypt to buy some grain. So it's been a long time. And the Bible mercifully spares us all of their activities in that time, because we don't really want to know anymore of what all they've done and who they've mistreated. Where we pick up, we see them in chapter 43 or 42. They make this first trip to Egypt because they're hungry. They need to get grain. And Joseph immediately recognizes them, but they don't recognize him. They just see this powerful Egyptian official that you got to talk to this guy if you want any food. And Joseph immediately knows who they are, but he knows that he's got this situation now. He can do anything he wants and they're not going to know. The Egyptian customs, the way of dressing, the way of talking, Joseph even pretends he can't even speak their language. You remember when he went before Pharaoh, they had to shave his head and put him all different clothes because the Egyptians had very different fashions. You know, you've seen the movies. You know, they're partially right. You know, the Egyptians like the bald look. You know, that's why they had Yul Brynner play the Pharaoh in those old movies. You know, it's bald people were real big in ancient Egypt. You know, Jim Robbins would have been a big hit. In fact, back in ancient Egypt, Frank Chappell was a big hit. They loved him back in ancient Egypt. And so they don't recognize him, and it's kind of a cat and mouse game that Joseph plays with them, because when he sees them again, the tables are turned. And you remember when he was a kid, he'd had those dreams of them bowing down to him. Now that it actually is fulfilled all these years later, that's not a big deal to Joseph anymore. What's more important to him, he's going to look into their hearts. He wants to find out what's going on with them, because he already has a sense that it's not about him. It's not about him teaching them a lesson. It's about them. That he's come to have peace with God despite all his sufferings. They need to come to have peace with God despite all their sin. God redeemed Joseph's life from all the sufferings and injustice he went through. God loves them just as much as he loves Joseph. And he wants to redeem them from their own sin and their own folly, because he wants to bless them too. And Joseph's going to be a big part of that. You remember, we looked last week, he sells them the grain, and he pretends, he accuses them of being spies. You guys, I think you guys are spies. And he kind of gets them to admit that they've got this other brother, Benjamin, who is now his father's favorite, because Joseph and Benjamin were Rachel's only children. And he gets them to admit that, and he says, okay, I'm going to give you your grain. I'm going to sell you this grain, but you can't come back unless you bring your youngest brother. And Joseph knows that his father's not going to like that. His father's not going to let that happen. So it's a test of his brothers. When they get hungry again, what are they going to do? Are they going to try to talk their dad into bringing Benjamin along, and how are they going to do it? And of course, these guys, they don't even stop and think, how is that going to prove they're not spies? It really isn't anything, but they're so afraid, they're so guilt-ridden, because do you remember when he said, I think you guys are spies, and I'm thinking of putting you in prison. Do you remember what their first reaction was? We're being punished for what we did to Joseph. 22 years ago, and they haven't forgotten. We always worry about people getting away with sin. We act just like the pagans. Look what he did. Someone needs to punish him. Look what he did. Someone needs to do something about that. People never, ever get away with sin. 22 years, they fooled their own father about what they did. No one ever found out. You know, never made a court appearance, never were arraigned or anything. They've paid the price. They paid the price for what they did all those years ago. They're still paying it, and they're going to pay and pay and pay because of what they did. And it's important to realize that people really never get away with sins. And where we pick up here, they're still carrying this burden around. In chapter 43, the famine was still severe in the land. If I could, I've had problems with my throat. I really like to get some people to read. Jim, could you read some verses for us? I'm sorry I made fun of your hirsute condition right there, but I would appreciate it if you'd do some reading. Could you read down to verse 7 for us?
Now the famine was still severe in the land. So when they had eaten all the grain they had brought from Egypt, their father said to them, go back and buy us a little more food. But Judah said to him, the man warned us solemnly, you will not see my face again unless your brother is with you. If you will send our brother along with us, we will go down and buy food for you. But if you will not send him, we will not go down, because the man said to us, you will not see my face again unless your brother is with you. Israel asked, why did you bring this trouble on me by telling the man you had another brother? They replied, the man questioned us closely about ourselves and our family. Is your father still living? He asked us. Do you have another brother? We simply answered his questions. How are we to know he would say, bring your brother down here?
Thanks very much. This just kind of sets the stage here. You see, here's their dilemma. They're facing the inevitable. They got that grain. Now we know, because Joseph has explained, this famine's going to last 7 years. So they're going to need to go back at some point for more grain. But they were kind of hoping it would just kind of last, you know, kind of meet it out a little bit at a time, because they know it's going to be a problem. If they have to go down there and take Benjamin, Jacob is going to freak out, because it's tough enough on him that he lost Joseph, and now Simeon is being held back in Egypt as a hostage, as part of Joseph's plan. And Jacob's just going to freak out if they want to take Benjamin away from him, because he's Jacob's little baby. And Jacob, of course, is not really dealing with reality either. He just, why don't you go back and buy a little grain? You know, why don't you just go to the corner drugstore and take care of this? And so they have to remind him, okay, now we've been over this, Pop. You know, we've been over this thing. We got to take Benjamin with us. And the whole thing starts up over again. And something worth noticing is, this is a spiritual reckoning that they've been putting off as long as possible. And it's a difficult decision, because it tugs at a lot of things deep in their hearts. All these tangled family relationships, all the mistakes that everybody's made, it's all been sitting there. And all these weeks and months that they're nibbling away at the grain, that's what's going on inside everybody's hearts. What are we going to do when we run out? And they just postpone it and postpone it and postpone it. And what's worth thinking about is, you see, these characters in the Bible, they're not given to us just so we can point at them and critique them and laugh at them and be glad that we're not like them. They're there to show us what we're like. Because we all have the same spiritual reckoning that's waiting for us in some way or another. Every one of us has issues, problems, people we need to talk to and work something through, something we haven't dealt with in a long time in our lives. We've all got these spiritual reckonings, and we do the same thing. We nibble away at our little bag of grain every day and just hope that it lasts for the rest of the famine. And God has a way of forcing you to deal with these things. God has a way of forcing you to deal with the things you fear the most. God has a way of bringing it to your attention in a way that you can't avoid. And it doesn't mean God's annoyed with you. It means God loves you. God has to force this family to deal with all their relationships, all the mess ups they've made, all the jealousies and rivalries. He's got to force them to deal with it for one reason. They have to deal with it for their own good. If they want to know him, if they want to understand him, if they want to get the real blessings of his presence in their lives, they have to deal with it because it's an obstacle. It's an insurmountable obstacle, and he's got to bring them through it. And so it's out of compassion that God forces them into this situation. Just like it's part of what Joseph needed to deal with all these painful years of slavery and imprisonment, he had to learn that humility and that complete dependence on God. He didn't even do anything wrong to have to be put through that. These guys, at least they deserve it. At least they deserve it if people hassle them a little bit for some of the stuff that they pulled on other people. But it's not punishment. It's compassion. It's what they need. And so they have to deal with a couple of things. First of all, the Benjamin problem. Benjamin is Jacob's pet. He's not going to let, he doesn't even let him go out of the house. He's so desperate. And he probably wasn't too good for Benjamin, but that's what happened. In fact, you know, if you, Linda's, my wife's family is Italian, and so I've learned to speak a lot of Italian. There's actually a phrase in Italian, un beniamino, a Benjamin, which means the teacher's pet, because it's where they get that from, that term from the Bible, because that's how Jacob treated him. And they have to deal with that problem. It's a real issue. It's an issue that Jacob's never dealt with. And it's an issue that these brothers are going to have to deal with. And there's also another problem, if you remember back to what we read in chapter 42. Joseph did something else that they would have to deal with. Remember what he did when he gave them their grain? He put something else in their bags.
He returned the silver.
Now, see, Joseph did something. This is the kind of thing that God actually does. He gave them that silver just as an act of grace, but how did they take it? What are they going to do when they find us? They couldn't even think. Maybe that guy likes us and he gave us a silver back. See, Joseph, that's the first of many hints that Joseph drops to them. But they're so consumed with their own guilt, their own self-centeredness, that they can't snap out of it and see things that are plainly obvious to everyone else. And we're going to see that more and more as we go here. Because when they finally get around to do that, Jacob loads him up with a bunch of gifts. What he does, we're not going to read it because we need to keep going, but Jacob, actually it's an intelligent thing to do. He gets some things that were only grown in Canaan, even though they had no grain and they were starving. There were a few specialty things like pistachios and things like that that you couldn't get in Egypt, and so he was hoping, why don't you take these to this guy, give them to him, give him the money back, pay double for the grain this time, because Jacob actually does have a lot of money, even though he doesn't have the food right now. He wants to let them know, yeah, we got good intentions here. And in fact, they don't even need to do any of that. When they get down to Egypt, picking up in verse 15 here, Brenda, could you read a few verses for us? Mm-hmm. Now to save my throat a little bit. Verse 15 down to 18 for right now.
Okay. So the men took the gifts and doubled the amount of silver, and Benjamin also. They hurried down to Egypt and presented themselves to Joseph. When Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the steward of his house, take these men to my house, slaughter an animal, and prepare a meal. They are to eat with me at noon. The man did as Joseph told him, and took the men to Joseph's house. Now then, the men were frightened when they were taken to his house. They thought, we were here because of the silver that was put back in our sacks the first time. He wants to attack us and overpower us and seize us as slaves and take our donkeys.
Here's some real interesting things here. They get this welcome reception. Hey, it's good to see you guys. Oh, it's great to see you. How's your old dad doing? How is everything? Come on in. We're going to have a big, big dinner. He's setting us up here. See, even if they've been even thinking at all, they'd realize they've seen this guy before, right? Whatever he says, the Egyptians do. He's the boss. If he wanted to throw him in jail, he didn't need to trick him. He didn't need to get him off someplace. He could throw him in jail without any reason. They're not even thinking clearly. We see over and over again, part of it is that these guys are not exactly what you would call the swiftest antelopes on the savannah. You know, that no self-respecting cheetah would even bother chasing one. But there's another thing going on too. It's their guilt. They're so blinded. And again, you just see over and over again how much they've paid the price for their sin. And he even says, you know, God's given you treasure in your sacks. And he said, because you go on here, verse 19 and 20 and 21. At 21 it says, when we opened our sacks, we found the silver and we brought it back. We brought additional silver. And he says, verse 23, it's all right. Don't be afraid. Your God, the God of your fathers, has given you treasure in your sacks. And why does he say that? Because this is true. Because God did give it to them. God gave it to them through Joseph. And it goes on here. He gets news about Jacob and Benjamin, and they have this real nice dinner together. And Joseph keeps dropping hints. He says down in verse 32, they served him by himself, the brothers by themselves, and the Egyptians by themselves, because Egyptians don't eat with Hebrews. The Egyptians were very, even at this time, the Egyptians were one of the most advanced societies in the world. And they had a lot of customs, and the Egyptians considered themselves very civilized, and most other people they were uncomfortable with, just because they thought they were barbarians. And so the Egyptians didn't like to eat with people from other countries just because of their table manners. And these guys in particular, they probably were some pretty rough customers too. But here's this real important Egyptian official sitting down to eat with them. And they don't think, what's he making the exception for? What's special about us? They think, he's trying to trick us. And then he goes in verse 33, the men were seated in the order of their ages. He sets them Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah. And they don't even stop to think, how in the world did he know that? It's just, wow, that's incredible. You know, what's going on here? And he just keeps making it more and more obvious to them, but they don't get it because the script, you remember that scripture in 2 Corinthians 5? In Christ, from now on, we regard no one from a worldly point of view. But that's so difficult. And the reason why it's difficult is because of our own, what psychologists like to call baggage, because we so naturally make these associations. We do look at people from a worldly point of view. We look at the church from a worldly point of view. We look at Jesus from a worldly point of view. We let the world form our opinions, our attitudes, our feelings, our beliefs, and even in obvious ways. And you're so blind to it that you let the world condition you, and you even impose the world's point of view on the Bible and on the church. You form these loyalties and beliefs and attachments almost without thinking. And if you don't believe it, I'm going to try to prove it to you. And this is the first of two little analogies. The other one's a logic puzzle on the board. This is the sillier one. So if you survive through this, you'll probably make it through the rest of the class. But I brought two of our friends. And Bobby Graham, when he filled in for Ron on graduation day, he set a bad precedent because he brought his toy, one of his toys. Bobby brought that sword, which he brandished around and frightened people like me, who are pacifists. I don't like weaponry. I'm a pacifist. Frank enjoyed it. Frank loved it. Frank likes sword fights and all that. I love animals. Now, I could have been like Bobby and brought real animals, but I didn't. And I also could have brought a goose because I really love geese, but I love Lloyd too, so I didn't want to cause Lloyd to stumble. These are two of Linda's stuffed animals. I like to play with them too. It's part of my therapy. But simple question. Okay, these are both male lions. Which one do you like better? Which one's cuter? Well, they're both really cute. They're different, right? And it's sure if we could take a poll, one would probably be a little bit more. But they're both cute little male lions. And if we voted, it probably wouldn't be a lot big difference, would it? Okay. Let's try something. Let's see if this changes your mind a little bit about which one you like better. Let's see if this makes you like one of them better than the other. Okay, for those of you listening on Jeff's audio tapes, we've just put a little Ohio State cap on one and a little yellow and blue cap on the other one. Do you like one of them better now? Yeah, I think so. I know this tells you a lot about your psychology, right? You like the one with the bunka hat. Now, just before anyone go, look, these visors belong to me too. Before anyone alerts the local authorities, this actually is not Michigan. It's actually the Toledo Rockets, the University of Toledo. I have a lot of Toledo memorabilia because my dad, a long time ago, played baseball up there. And so they don't have the same colors. It just looks like them. I knew it would look like Michigan. Toledo's colors are blue and gold, not maize and blue. It's not maize, it's gold, and it's in a different order. See, maize and blue and gold. So it's not Michigan, but I knew the psychological effect that it would have on you. See, and I knew this because I live with one of the fanatic Buckeye fans. You, Linda would root for anything with Buckeye colors on. You could take two cockroaches and paint one scarlet and gray, and she'd stomp on the other one and take the scarlet and gray one and build a little house and feed it. Because anything Buckeye, she will love. And it's the way people are. You let the world provoke you into these immediate emotional attachments that run very deep inside your psyche, but they're very superficial in reality. And I saw this yesterday because we had the entertaining spectacle of watching the soccer game yesterday with an assortment of people. And there were people there, and their names will be withheld to protect the guilty, because there were people there who know nothing about soccer. They don't know any of the players. They don't even know the rules. There are people that ask us, what do they do? What's that mean? And then, they're living and dying with everything. We're going to go, oh no, we're not going to go. Oh. And then at the end of the game, it's, oh, we lost. Oh. You don't even know anything. It's just they put an American flag on it. We're supposed to root for them. You're supposed to root for them. Yeah, like, people don't even know what's going on. And yet they form this passionate loyalty to things like that. And it's funny, but it's, see, you let the world do that in a lot more serious ways, too. You let the world just pull and tug you along. Oh, I should mention, by the way, since we have a lot of our friends from Ghana here, now you can report me to the authorities if you want, but I actually was happy that Ghana won, because it will mean a lot more to them, because they actually really love the game down there. Most Americans, it's kind of an affectation to pretend to like it a couple months out of the year. I just was wondering, since Ghana apparently intends to start winning championships now, I was wondering if we could make a deal, because for a long time, we've been trying to get someone to take the Yankees and the Lakers off our hands. Since Ghana's going to start winning championships, could we maybe like move the Yankees over to Accra, have the Accra Yankees, and maybe put the Lakers in Kumasi? Because it doesn't really make sense to call a team from Los Angeles the Lakers, and you have Lake Volta is a lot bigger lake than anything they have in California. So we'd like to get rid of them, and they could win championships over there and give some of our teams a chance. But see, the point is that people form these superficial loyalties. And you see this all the time. And it's done in more serious ways than sports, too. It's one of the things that if you want to teach class, you don't even need to look hard for material, because there's so much material out there. Linda turned on TV this morning when I was getting my stuff ready. She turns on the TV to check the weather, and instead of the weather, there's this character on there. We're reporting from the defeated United States soccer camp here, and we've just spoken with the coach who is devastated by this shocking loss. And it's, what? So their guy kicked the ball into the net once more than our guy did. You know, that's okay. That's fine. It's not a big deal. We're not gonna. We don't have to surrender to them or anything like that. You know, it's fun. And somewhere it was funny when we were watching the game, because somebody in their research department looked up the populations, and they were making this big point. The United States is losing to a country with that they're 15 times bigger than this country. You know, the way he said it, you know, these ESPN commentators are kind of inarticulate. He said, the U.S. is 15 times bigger than this other team, and they're losing. And he kind of made it sound like the players are 15 times bigger. So we were wondering, maybe these Ghana players, maybe they're really hollow, and that's why they're 15 times bigger. And they kept repeating it. And of course, the sports commentators being what they are, they couldn't settle on one number. One of them said they're 15 times bigger, and the other one said they're losing to a nation 10 times smaller than they are. They couldn't even get it right. It's like, you got to get it in perspective. Because you see, any sports competition, or almost any, it involves a lot of luck. And usually the better team wins, but it's usually not by a lot. And you'll see the same game that, depending on a few breaks here and there, one team wins and one team loses. But they'll always say to the coach that wins, they'll ignore all the goof-ups that his team made, and they'll say, "Coach, what was it about your team that you came through at the crucial moment today?" And they'll say to the other guy, "Coach, it's got to be a devastating loss. I mean, I'm sure you're questioning your character. Where do you think you went wrong today?" It's like people can't just watch these things and enjoy it. I should say, the people who invited me over, who I'm making fun of, they're very tolerant, because I'm not very reliable at sporting events. Because I like watching them just because I enjoy watching the strategies and learning the players. And it's interesting to me, but I don't really care that much who wins. And so people tend not to invite me over for the big game. So I appreciate it when they do, and then I make fun of them in class the next morning. But the point is that, see, this is what's going on with these guys. They're so fixated on their own little world. They can't snap out of it. Joseph keeps making it obvious. Who would know what order all your ages are in? Who would care about your father? Who would, he just keeps dropping these hints, and they're just, what's he doing now? And that's what we are all the time with what God's trying to do with us. It's always, we just don't see it because we're so, we got our tiny little minute agendas that we don't see anything. And we form worldly loyalties and fuss about things. And it's just goofy. And when Joseph goes on, we've got to abridge some of this because we're starting to run late, but Joseph has this last stratagem that he uses to really give him the final test before he reveals himself. Joseph's just bursting to tell him who he is. He doesn't have any rancor towards them. He doesn't have any malice towards them. He's bursting to tell them who he is. But he understands there's something bigger going on. He's got to find out what's in their hearts. And he has this last stratagem, chapter 44. He tells the steward, okay, fill up their sacks with grain again, put their silver back in again, and then take my cup, the silver one, put it in the mouth of the youngest one's sack. He puts his own special cup in Benjamin's sack, and he goes through this little charade to have them arrested. So he has them arrested, and when they're arrested, they find the cup in whose sack? Benjamin. And he says, okay, that one's going to be my slave now. Rest of you go home to your dad. Take the grain with my blessings. So what's he trying to do? Before he lets them know what's happening, he's going to find out what's in their hearts, because they've got some options here. Okay, fine, no problem. Yeah, little punk, go to jail. You know, he stole your cup, he deserves it. But here, they're forced, maybe for the first time in a long time, to think of other people as human beings. They think of their dad, they think of Benjamin. And here, Judah's Jesus' ancestor, and up till now, we've seen him as one of the biggest clods in this bunch of disreputable characters. But verse 18, Judah went up to him and said, "Please, my Lord, let your servant speak a word to my Lord. Do not be angry with your servant, though you are equal to Pharaoh himself." And he goes on, "My Lord asked the servants, 'Do you have a father or brother?' And we answered, 'We have an aged father, and there's a young son born to him in his old age. His brother's dead, and he's the only one of his mother's son left, and his father loves him.'" And he goes on to say, look, I know that you can do anything you want to us, but he ends up saying, just take me, do whatever you want to me, but it's really important. This young kid, he's innocent, he's had a tough time, his father really loves him, we just kill our dad, so I feel responsible. And he's telling the truth for the first time in his life, probably, and he's not trying to talk someone into doing something for his own benefit for a change. And it comes across as really sincere all of a sudden, and he does gloss over one detail. When they get to Joseph, it's like, our brother died, and he goes on to the rest of the story there. But it's really a change in Judah. And the thing that's interesting to ask yourself is, why did Judah all of a sudden change? Did he read a Christian bestseller? How to Think Like God. These little books that they give out here. Step one, do this. Read this verse. Step two, say this prayer. Don't you think like God? No method was involved, was it? There wasn't any method. He didn't go to some motivational workshop. God put him through the ringer. He just endured through the stuff God did and learned the lessons God taught him. What did Joseph do? How did Joseph become qualified to be Pharaoh's governor? Did he read a book? How to rise up from prison to be a governor? No, he didn't read a book. He didn't watch a TV special on anything. It just, he lived his life where God put him, who God put him with, and was as much of a blessing as he could be. And God did the rest of it. He didn't have to push things. And Judah is so filled with compassion and concern that it says in chapter 45, Joseph could no longer control himself. Even if he needed to wait, he just can't do this anymore, because he knows what he wants to know now. And you see, the thing that's so great about this is Joseph is acting so much like God, because all God wanted to see these guys do is just break down and humble themselves and acknowledge that things are beyond their control. It's all he wanted. They're not going to ever have to do anything to make up for what they've done. They're never going to have to do a thing. They just have to accept grace. He goes on, he says, "Have everyone leave my presence." So there's no one with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers. And he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard him, and Pharaoh's household heard about it. Joseph said to his brothers, "I'm Joseph. Is my father still living?" But his brothers were not able to answer because they were terrified. You ever have that experience where something you believe with all your heart, and all of a sudden, someone just stands up and realizes, it's the other way around. It's really upsetting. And it's a real test of your heart when you do that. And it's terrifying to come face to face with things you believe real strongly and realize now it's wrong. And Joseph says, "Come close to me." When they've done so, he said, "I'm your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now, you're going to pay for what you did to me, because you're real stinkers. He says, don't be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now there's been famine. For 5 more years and I'm going to be plowing or reaping, but God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant. When you think remnant, you think you better have the right answer, or you're going to have a long side issue here on Isaiah, because it's Isaiah. Remnant is a big deal in the Old Testament, because God sent you ahead of me to preserve a remnant, to prepare for the future. And he sent me ahead of you to save your lives by a great deliverance. And it's such a God-like attitude to see that God takes this rotten behavior on that part and turns it to good. Here's where this is a little logic puzzle to give you. And this, if you study deductive logic, which I know a lot of you do in your spare time, this is a little puzzle that you see adapted once in a while. There's these two guys, Biff and Spiff. All you know about him is that Biff always lies no matter what, and Spiff always tells the truth no matter what. And so you go to their house and you knock on the door, and the first one wears his green shirt, he comes out and says, "Hi, I'm," and when he tells you his name, the traffic noise drowns it out, so you don't know what he said. And then the other brother comes out here, and he says, he said he's Biff, and I'm Spiff. And you gotta figure out from that, who's who. Jack, sorry that you're late. We were just talking about how big of a hit you would have been in ancient Egypt. You'll have to ask someone why. All you know, you didn't hear what he says, and this guy says, you know, he said he was Biff. Well, see, it's a logic puzzle, because who did he say? Suppose he's the liar, Biff. What would he say? Well, he'd claim to be Spiff, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
Suppose he's Spiff, the guy that tells the truth, what would he say? Well, then he'd tell the truth and say he's Spiff. So either way, he said, you don't have to hear what he said. You know he's going to tell you he's Spiff. So when he says, he said he was Biff, what do you know?
He's lying.
He's lying. So this is Biff, and this is Spiff. The point that I'm making is, he would tell you the same thing either way. If he was a liar, he's going to tell you that he's Spiff, and he's the truth teller to tell you he's Spiff. So you get the same result either way. You don't have to even hear what he says to know that this guy's telling you a lie. And the connection that I'm making here, tenuous though it may be, is that just as you don't have to hear what this guy says, you know, whether by foul means or fair, you know what he said. And you can use that information to judge what this guy says. God doesn't need for us to do something good or wonderful for him to work in your life. God used these characters and their awful behavior towards their brother to do something that blessed the whole world, to do something that brought physical nourishment and spiritual nourishment to a world. And it's an amazing thing about God that God's logical patterns are so much different than ours. We just so much insist on forcing God into a box. Good in, good out. Bad in, bad out. God goes around and slaps around all the bad guys and gives cookies to all the good guys. It just doesn't work that way. God wants to bless everybody. He wants to bless you. He wants to bless the people that you love and think are wonderful. He wants to bless the people that you hate and think are terrible. He wants to bless everybody. God treats people differently because everyone needs different things. Everyone's got different spiritual needs. Joseph was put through this horrible time, even though he didn't do anything to deserve it, because of what God wanted to do with them. Joseph needed to learn that absolute dependence on God. God needed to make sure that Joseph would do the right thing just because it was the right thing. His brothers got off easy. They had this one traumatic experience in front of this whacked out governor that terrified them for a few hours. And that's it. For selling their brother as slaves. That's what they got. Or is it?
No.
Well, in their hearts, the price was a lot different. And you see, that's where we got to stop looking at the world's questions of justice. And you know, I sometimes compare it to those little ink blob tests that the psychologists give you. When you look at the things that go on in the world, in your life, and even in the church, we so often project those worldly attitudes onto these things. We read the Bible, and we even use the Bible, but we do it in a worldly way. We react to things with worldly attitudes, and you see it all the time. And some things were okay. Everybody's got their weak points. And this is a serious thing. One of my weak points is, you know, I'm a nut about nature, animals, and stuff like that. And you know, we have this thing going on with this awful oil spill down in the Gulf and everything, and everybody's up in a tizzy about it. And the thing is, yeah, that's about, to me, that's about the worst possible thing. Because even though, I mean, I know you, they show on the news the pictures of the poor pelicans with oil all over them. That's horrifying enough to me. But actually, they're not even telling you what's really worst about it. They're not even telling you the worst animal suffering and destruction of the environment and that. Basically, because people on the news aren't smart enough to understand what really is the worst things about it. But we'll save that for another time when I go back to bashing Fox News and CNN again. The point is that I want to make to you, that's a horrible thing to me. It really upsets me viscerally. And it's the kind of thing that makes, you know, when they touch something that's really dear to you, what's the natural human reaction? It's to lash out, to want someone to pay. And, you know, I'm seeing these polls in all the news, these, you know, every news channel's got these opinion polls. Who is at fault for this disaster going on as it has? And you see these polls and it's so many percent blaming on the president of the oil company and think he should be shot, and so many people blame it on the president, and which I don't know why, what they expect the president to do. I guess just because he's in pretty good shape, he's supposed to swim down to the bottom and stick his finger in the hole? I don't know. It's just that people want to blame somebody, right? And the point is, it doesn't matter who you're blaming. The point is, the problem is in that craving to blame, that craving to punish. And it's the same thing if your sports team loses the big game and you want to figure out whether it's the coach or that dumb player that dropped the pass or the announcers for jinxing your team by quoting the wrong statistic or some silly thing. It doesn't matter what the issue is. It's that blame thing. Because what is Joseph doing here? It doesn't matter whose fault it was. It doesn't matter if it's dad's fault for playing favorites. It doesn't matter if it's Reuben's fault that he couldn't save me from you guys. It doesn't matter whether it's Judah's fault for thinking up the idea to sell me. It doesn't matter. Because God took the whole ugly mess and used it for something wonderful. And I know how hard it is. It's very hard for me not to get very angry at somebody for killing off all my friends in the wild. I know I'm overly emotional about it. The point is, you probably don't get all emotional about pelicans and microorganisms, but you do get all emotional about something else. I don't know what it is, but you get all emotional about something else. And the point is, you know when you've got the gospel, when whatever it is that really hits at your weak point, when you can say, I know God is going to do something with this that humans can't. The test isn't, can you look at a whacked out, duck-loving neurotic like me and say, oh, well, he should just calm down about that. The test is when it comes to your weak point, when something happens that really rips you apart, can you stand back and say, okay, we're here by grace anyway, and I'm gonna be like Joseph. Joseph had every right in the world to really rip his brothers. Joseph had every right in the world to punish him. He didn't. God has every right in the world to punish all of us. He doesn't. And it's a difference in perspective. It's so hard to get. But God's logic is not like ours. God's sense of justice is not like ours, because God's sense of justice is based on grace. It's not based on balancing the scales and balancing out the books and calculating and allotting things. It's based on, well, there's so many needs out there. There's so many people who are hurting that let's focus on just helping the people who need it. Focus on washing off the poor pelicans. Don't go around trying to shoot somebody for it. It's more important to try to meet the needs that are there, because everybody's hurting somehow. Everybody's got the needs. And if you aren't hurting in some way, so much the better, because there's a lot of people who really need it. And it's just the perspective that comes from understanding the gospel. So we'll pick up with there. I ran over again, but we'll let you go. Thanks for your attention, and I'll be back next time with some equally goofy demonstrations of one sort or another.